The EMS Educast is a podcast by and for EMS educators. Every week, our panel of education experts hosts a program that brings you the latest and greatest in EMS education technology, methods, and techniques. Your hosts will regularly bring you guests from all over the world to tell you about innovative EMS education programs and experiences in other places. Join us each week for the EMS Educast. And visit www.emseducast.com to subscribe with iTunes or the RSS feed, listen to archived shows, and view future show descriptions. The EMS Educast.
This episode of the EMS Educast is sponsored by EMS Manager. Visit emsmanager.net for a free trial of this innovative and easy-to-use EMS employee scheduling and management software.
Welcome. This is the first summer show of the EMS Educast. I think the spring semester wrapped up a few weeks ago. We've had a couple weeks off to spend time with friends and family, and we're going to be podcasting a little less often during the summer, but we expect to still make about two episodes a month. I'm Greg Fries, one of the regular co-hosts. So glad to be recording again. It has been a few weeks. Rob, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Have you been running lots of great calls during your summer break?
I'm still at the college.
Okay.
Until the end of this week, so I'm doing my regular five shifts a month. But as you guys probably heard, we had a terrible tragedy here in Ontario about 3 weeks ago. Air Ambulance helicopter crashed just outside of Moosonee, and we lost two pilots and two flight paramedics.
How far away from that is from you is that location?
That's about probably a 14-hour drive north.
Oh, wow. And all aeromedical in Canada done with the two pilots?
I'm not sure about the rest of the country, but in Ontario, all of our aircraft are staffed with two pilots, and all aircraft are twin-engine. Okay. And we have an extraordinarily safe safety record in Ontario. This is, I believe, the third crash with fatalities in the last 30 years.
Wow.
So, and we don't have, we have, well, one of the largest single air ambulance systems in the world here in Ontario called Orin. I believe we do about 60 patient transports per day.
The thing that caught my attention was the dual pilots in the system there. And I may be making a generalization, but I would say that would be the exception here in the States. So thanks for remembering your colleagues, Rob, in Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
Bill, do you have maybe something more cheerful as we move forward in the episode?
Well, of course things are more cheerful next Thursday. Well, first of all, if there's a podcast next Wednesday, I won't be here because okay. On Sunday I leave for Aruba, and next Thursday I get married.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Oh, fantastic.
Congratulations, Bill. That's very exciting.
I keep hoping to see you show up on the beach because you're going to be more romantic with your wife this year.
Yeah, that is not going to happen, unfortunately. I just couldn't figure out how to make that happen. The trip to Aruba, that is. I have several strategies to be more romantic, but we'll not record those on the podcast.
Thank you.
Well, congratulations, Bill. Listeners, make sure you go to facebook.com/EMSEducast and share your well wishes with Bill. And if you're going to be in Aruba, make sure you look for him on the beach and help him celebrate. So that's fantastic news, Bill. We're very happy for you.
Thank you.
Well, we have some guests for this episode tonight. I can't recall maybe where I first learned about this, but I was reading something about the Medication Administration cross-check, and then I saw, well, this is in Kansas, and you know, Bill's got to be able to introduce us to the right people here, and so we're so glad to have Paul. I've been struggling with how to say this, Paul, but Paul Massassi. How do you say
close. Massassi.
Massassi and Dr. Joseph Keebler on the show to discuss the Medication Administration cross-check program that they've developed there. But before you start telling us about the program, we want to hear about you and your education, your background in EMS, sort of all the wonderful things that led you to this point of doing this work.
Well, like you said, I'm here in Kansas. I started with Central County EMS back in 2003. Actually, I left high school in Tulsa to go to Oklahoma State. Was headed to be a professional pilot. I was enrolled in the aviation education program at Oklahoma State University, and got my pilot's license, instrument rated, and complex endorsement. And then I moved to back to Wichita, where my family was, and finished college out at Wichita State University, and got a bachelor's degree in health service organization policy in 2001. And then went to become a paramedic, actually wanting to be a paramedic the whole time. I graduated college in 3 years as fast as I possibly could so I could go to paramedic school. And I guess the reason it went in that order is because every paramedic I talked to said, go get your bachelor's degree first. And so I did. And I went to paramedic school through Coffeyville Community College. Got an Associate of Applied Science through that program. And while I was working as a field medic for Sedgwick County EMS, I pursued continuing education through the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and got a master's degree, Master's of Science in Emergency Health Services through UMBC and their program there. And spent about 8 years in the field running calls downtown Wichita, and have since been promoted into management. And just rounded out my second year in April, and my official title is Deployment and Quality Improvement Manager. And so one of the things I was tasked with as I moved up into the office was really understanding processes from a systems approach and designing improvement interventions. And we can talk about it a little bit later, but that's really what led us into reduction of medication errors. So that I think that probably rounds me out pretty good here. I'll let Dr. Keeble introduce himself. Well,
maybe before we get to him, just I think that's a great background. And I think, first of all, you're lucky to have met so many paramedics that told you to finish up that bachelor's degree before you got your paramedic certification. But what happened to the pilot, becoming a pilot?
Well,
working in aviation,
I fell in love, and you know how things go from there. It just plans change. I realized spending my life in hotels wasn't for me, or I wanted to be a family man, so I didn't want to spend 2/3 of my time in hotel lobbies and chasing around flight attendants. So I decided, my whole family is healthcare. My mother's a physician. My stepfather's a physician. My father's a physician, and now my brother's a surgeon.
Okay.
Wow. And I'm the ambulance driver of the family. I'm making them proud. But my brother is a third year resident. Excuse me, here in Wichita as well.
Okay.
And so I've grown up in medicine, so it's always been and seemed to come naturally to me. I remember actually what sparked my interest in EMS was while I was at Oklahoma State, I met an EMT who was a Maryland EMT, and I remember just thumbing through some of the textbooks he had and thinking, man, this is really cool. I remember thinking how cool the Sedgwick County EMS paramedics looked like when I saw them out and about, and became an EMT while I was going to Wichita State. And I took like 25 credit hours that semester and managed to pull that off and join the reserves here with Sedgwick County EMS. They weren't real crazy about me as a reserve because I didn't do all the standbys. I just wanted to do all the ride-alongs and actually run calls. But EMS is like aviation. Once you kind of run your first call or take your first flight, it gets in your blood, and it's always there. I think to myself every time I pass a lottery billboard or something, that I'm going to buy myself a Pilatus or a Learjet someday, and if someone offered me that job, I'd jump all over it and just just fly around the world for a while. But I was actually licensed as a pilot in 1999, but it's been well over a decade since I've been pilot in command on any aircraft. But it actually served me pretty well, because as fate would have it, crew resource management, which actually was a semester class when I took it at OSU, it was called cockpit resource management at the time, has made its way to healthcare. So it's like, hey, I've already had some exposure to this, and it made sense to me then, and it certainly makes sense in how we're trying to apply it in what we do.
Interesting, as you mentioned, cockpit resource management, because there's a podcast, the latest podcast by Dr. Scott Weingart from EMCRIT, where he has a physician who's a jet fighter pilot, gives a presentation on the concept of crew resource management in emergency medicines. It's worth a listen.
Well, I've read the book by Paul Lesage, The Principles and Practice as it's applied into the emergency service field, and even here at Sedgwick County EMS, we've made an introduction to field crews, just what CRM's really about. It's kind of one of those things I think where it's kind of hard to define, just because it's made up of so many concepts, the communication, team dynamics, and that sort of thing. I think as you start to apply it, and one of the notions we passed along to our team leaders in our leadership academy was we've started doing crew resource management. We introduced it to you, but we've started doing it in some of the things that we've been doing, like checklists and verbal verification and, some of the things that we've tried to do through to improve situation awareness and some of those things that are hard to define. And really just our best, I think, and from what I understand, implemented with specific tasks rather than just trying to teach people what it is and expect them to go out and do it.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Joe Novak, I think it is, who's the doctor, gives a presentation, has this great line about efficient and unambiguous communication, where he says it should be three things: directive, descriptive, informative. And he goes on to elaborate on those. It's really quite brilliant.
Well, and so there's a very nice video done by the Clinical Human Factors Group, which is in England, by a gentleman, I'll think of his name in a second, but he is a airline pilot, and his wife had a tragic outcome where her airway collapsed, and so they've got a whole reenactment of the, I think it was a routine sinus surgery that she was undergoing, where she just essentially desaturated, and everybody, fiddled around with an airway and didn't pay attention to ventilating, and she became comatose and died. And so he started the Clinical Human Factors Group to really begin speaking the language. And one of the comments he makes is in aviation, everybody speaks the language of human factors, but what he tried to understand is why that's not part of clinical practice. And I've come to realize that we, in my belief, in medicine are at the same place that aviation was in the 70s, where technology can only improve the safety of what we're doing to a certain point. We're at an asymptote of safety. And just like aviation, if it's going to get any safer, we have to, one, understand the errors that we make, and to craft just everyday work practices that limit the ability for those errors to reach patients or produce themselves. So it's about stopping errors before they happen, and if they happen, mitigating the consequences of those errors. So it really has piqued my interest in human factors. I've consumed as much information as possible on human factor psychology and crew resource management, system safety. I've also got a bit of a background in the dreaded Six Sigma, which for some reason every quality manager laughs when I say that. But
are you a black belt?
No. I've had the yellow belt introductory course in it, and which is just essentially an exposure to the concepts, which really is, it's just kind of quality improvement packaged in a different way. Yes, there's some very nice tools and some important tools, but they're tools. They're not, it is not the be all end all, in my opinion. I could be wrong.
So listeners, if you go to the show notes at the episode blog post for this episode, I've included the link for the MCRIT podcast 99, this CRM textbook by Lesage, and then this video. It's just a routine operation that's featuring, I believe, Martin Bromley,
who founded
the Clinical Human Factors Group. So there'll be a link to all these things in the show notes for this episode.
Greg, how do you do that so quickly behind the scenes? You just amaze me.
Well, I have a whole staff of sort of reference librarian research specialists here at my disposal that are able to, they're listening in and seek these things out.
So one of the biggest barriers, I think, that Martin Bromley's video helps paramedics identify is that it's not for a lack of clinical knowledge or deftness or craftsmanship that things go badly. You can have some of the most experienced and skilled and knowledgeable providers doing what they do, and things go badly for reasons that have nothing to do with their clinical knowledge. And I think as clinicians, in general, we have a tendency to blame the last person that touched whatever it was that broke and identify them as the deficient part to the system and essentially adhere to what Decker, you know, refers to as the bad apple theory, is that if we got rid of all the bad apples, we wouldn't have any problems.
Call that culture of blame.
So, Dr. Keebler, we just heard you join the conversation there. So why don't you introduce yourself and
sure.
Tell listeners about your involvement in this.
So I worked on my PhD from 2006 to 2011 at the University of Central Florida in Orlando. Before that, I was bounced around a little bit. I'm originally from New Jersey. I studied philosophy for a couple years, realized that wasn't going to really get me anywhere. And then I jumped into pre-med, found out that I really liked the mind, or I should say the brain, and realized I really wanted to do psychology, and then switched to getting a BS in psychology. I got that in 2005, and then started a PhD program at UCF in Applied Experimental Human Factors Psychology. And my original research actually was I did a lot of military research, and combat identification errors were my major focus for most of my research there and my dissertations on that topic. And I was interested at the time in how do you train soldiers to identify vehicles, because we were firing and on our own vehicles a lot, and there's been a lot of incidences of fratricide, which is soldier, you know, blue on blue, where our own soldiers shoot at our own vehicles, and when a tank's coming over a hill at you, you panic and you shoot at it. And so I tried to devise some different ways for training efficiently and effectively and quickly, because soldiers don't have much time to train on these kinds of things. So that was my background at first. So I had this kind of training background. And then at the same time, you know, as a graduate student, you never just work on one thing. I did a lot of research on human command and control teams, specifically for unmanned vehicle assets. So how do you get a bunch of guys in a room controlling unmanned aerial vehicles, unmanned ground vehicles out in the field, you know, 10,000 miles away, and have them be effective as a team? Following my PhD work, I started a postdoc under Eduardo Salas, who's actually an IO psychologist, and he's a world leader in human factors, industrial organizational psychology, and his main focus is teamwork and team training. And so I spent a year under him looking at teamwork and team training, and this was across naval research. So we had some funding from the ONR and also medical research that we were doing with the Team Steps program, which is funded by the AHRQ and DOD. And so my postdoc, I spent some time using my statistical knowledge, which is one of the things I'm lucky to have a good statistical ability, and I learned all that stuff pretty well in my classes, so I helped do some large sample analyses and figure out some stuff, and we got some publications under review right now on those topics. And then about a year later, I got a job offer here at Wichita State, and I came out here and started the Trace Lab, Training Research and Applied Cognitive Engineering Lab at Wichita State in their Human Factors Psychology program. And actually, that's how I met Paul, because I do research 50% and I teach 50%. And Paul took my research methods class, and he knew Ed Salas from his background reading resource management, which is something Ed had worked on. And so Paul invited me to, you know, start collaborating. And I have a very deep interest still in the military stuff. I'm still doing research with the Army, but I've definitely caught on to the healthcare research. And my wife is actually also a human factors psychologist, and she has done healthcare research for the last 7 years. Her entire PhD experience was almost strictly healthcare, with a little bit of other things, but she almost did entirely healthcare research. So right now I'm working on a bunch of grants, and we have some projects with Children's Mercy Hospital and their pediatric program out there in Kansas City. I was just actually out there this weekend looking at handoff protocols. We're trying to figure out the best way to implement handoff and passing of information. So my expertise really lies in developing training and understanding teamwork and team training. And I think it's oftentimes we look at task work and we say, oh, someone's an expert. So you have a medical doctor or an EMT guy or gal, and they're experts at what they do. They know how to do every part of their job as well as you possibly can. But what people are not trained on is teamwork. And teamwork itself is a skill that you need to become an expert at. And I think one of the major things that we'll need to change, and it's already happening, but it's going to be a probably long and rocky road, is getting this teamwork mentality kind of instilled into the training programs for doctors and nurses and everyone who works together on a team that comes from disparate fields. And so the IOM, back at the Institutes of Medicine, released a report, it was almost 12 years ago, I guess now, or maybe 13 years ago, 2000 or 1999, showing how much medical error there was and how many people were dying every year from medical error. And so what they've changed is already, they've shortened the doctor's amount of hours that they had to put in residence. They're now doing 80 instead of 120 because these guys or gals were working 3 work weeks in 1 week, and they were exhausted and their minds were shutting down and they were making errors. They're cross-training nurses with doctors so that early on, the doctors and nurses are learning about each other's skill sets and how to work as a team before they actually ever work on a patient together. And so these are the kind of things that I want to adopt, into medicine and continue to adopt into medicine. These, like Paul said, have been researched in aviation extensively because the field of human factors was really born out of World War II aviation. And with the trying to keep up with the German forces, our technology was advancing very quickly. And we weren't standardizing things. We were just kind of throwing guys in planes that they'd never flown, and we were having a lot of accidents. And so they brought psychologists in to kind of figure out how to mitigate these issues. And for about 40 years, 50 years, they were still working on that. There's still next-gen aviation research coming out even now. So we're still doing aviation research. And World War II, we're talking about, we're going on almost 80 years now. So we got another century probably before we figure out healthcare, or maybe even more. And I want to be a part of that, and that's kind of the culture I came out of. So I
walked into Dr. Shaparo's office, who's the chair of the psychology department at Wichita State. I walked into his office it's well over a year ago, and after realizing that Wichita State has a human factors program. Like I said, I'd done a lot of my own reading and came across the Human Factors and Ergonomics website and was surfing through there and found that they have an accreditation of programs and one of the, I think it's one of the 15 accredited programs in the United States by the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society. And so I walked into Dr. Shaparo's office and I essentially said that my epiphany that what I believe is human factors is really the next phase for improving patient safety and medicine in general. and that nobody really seems to have substantially picked up on the language in EMS, at least. And I said, I know you got to have some grad students, you know, looking to do some research, and I've got data coming out my ears that I've got nobody to do anything with. So I said, surely you can send me an intern or somebody. I've got all kinds of research that could be going on, and seminal research that could occur. We don't have, like anyone else, have the capacity internally to engage that that type of work when everybody's trimming budgets up. So he said at that time, he said, well, we're looking, I've got a couple human factors docs that have some medical background coming from Florida. He said they'll be here after the end of the summer. And so as soon as they got into town, I went over and sank my claws into them and told them about, you know, there's this field, it's called EMS, and, you know, it's pretty dangerous and a lot of people get hurt. You know, this is really, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit here that we can look at and make significant improvements in. There's a lot of practices in EMS that are adopted simply because they were, they're conventional in the hospital, so we extend them out into the pre-hospital arena, and that doesn't necessarily, as we all know, make for good practice. And so,
hey guys, we're going to take a short pause right here to hear from our sponsor. And then we'll come right back and we'll start digging into this medication administration cross-check.
This episode of the EMS Educast is sponsored by EMS Manager. They have been consistently helping EMS agencies save time and energy with their innovative web-based software for staff scheduling and management. There's a mobile web app accessible from smartphones or other mobile devices with an easy-to-use web interface viewable from anywhere on the World Wide Web. You can check your own schedule, and managers and staff can oversee, manage, and make changes to employee schedules from anywhere. One Indiana EMS service manager called scheduling a part-time job all by itself, but with EMS Manager, he was able to schedule an entire month of coverage in just a few hours. That's a significant amount of time and money saving for services struggling to make ends meet. It's affordable, too. Pricing for EMS Manager is based on the size of your organization, and because it's web-based, your employee schedule and software is located in the cloud, meaning there is no additional local IT cost to worry about. And there's always free training, free tech support, and free system software updates. If you want this for your system, check out the free customizable trial of EMS Manager at emsmanager.net. We would like to thank EMS Manager for sponsoring the EMS Educast and other shows from the ProMed Network. EMS Manager is proud to support EMS providers and managers through this sponsorship and the support of what we do. Show your support for them. Take a few minutes and sign up for the free trial at emsmanager.net. Show them that you appreciate their support by trying out the software. Visit emsmanager.net for LADtech's EMS Manager for online employee scheduling and workplace management. Let them know you heard it here on the EMS Educast. emsmanager.net.
You know, I'm just fascinated by the work that both of you have done and the education background. I mean, it's really pretty incredible. And to sort of combine, I mean, it's this sort of like chocolate and peanut butter situation that, you know, the experience you have in aviation, Paul, and then the Joseph, you show up in Wichita with all this, you know, systems and team and human factors background and are looking for research projects. And so it's really neat how that came together. Maybe just, if this might only be for me, but let's just like, let's put a definition and maybe some examples of what, you know, what's human factors and what does that like look like specifically in EMS with how errors are created?
So, Greg, this is Joe. So human factors in its most general sense is the integration of human beings with systems. It's a very broad definition because a system can be defined as a pen and it's ergonomically designed so it fits in your hand to the cockpit of a fighter jet or of a space shuttle.
Mightier than the sword.
Yeah, right. Well, now the computer keyboard, but yeah, agreed. And so in general, that's what it is. And so in the area I'm in, so there's what we call physical ergonomics, which is designing your chair so it's all nice and comfy, designing pens, designing keyboards so they don't hurt your wrists, designing manufacturing equipment so guys don't get hurt. And then there's what we call cognitive ergonomics or cognitive engineering, and that's kind of looking at knowledge structures and testing and surveying people and how you build these surveys so you understand things, how you test people to evaluate their knowledge, how you train people through simulations or through actual practice and assess them while they're in the operational environment, which is the actual real-world environment. And so this human systems integration really is the kind of crux of at least what I do and my side of human factors. I'll never design a chair. I don't know really much about it. But what I can design is a test, or what I can do is evaluate, Paul's data from his cross-check. He can bring that to me, and I know how to run statistics on it to figure out if there's anything actually happening and what we can do to make it better. And really, it comes down to really rigorous science, and you got to be a good scientist. At the end of the day, we're trained to be extremely rigorous scientists because we're in psychology. It's already kind of harped on for being what we call soft science. And in the fact that that's unfortunate, it's also a blessing because we have to be very rigorous and we have to have very strong metrics, very strong statistical tests, validated metrics, and we have to conduct valid science. And unfortunately, and not to say anything bad about medicine, but a lot of medical researchers in general don't understand a lot of the major rigorous scientific concepts that we bring to the table. And so we partner very well with MDs as well. Now, I look at the EMS literature, and I've only looked at a bit of it. Actually, EMS is kind of more towards psychology with how rigorous they are with their methods. And so there just seems to be a human factors can really bring this kind of systematic approach to scientific inquiry to make sure that what we're implementing, whatever it may be, is valid and is improving outcomes. And, mostly those outcomes are patient safety and provider satisfaction. So,
and what I'll say is the way I think about human factors is, or cognitive ergonomics is the way the human mind interacts with the work the person is doing. And so and I'm kind of interested in process design and which is what wound up producing the medication CrossCheck, is how do people perceive what it is that they're doing? Wichita State also, that's anything from just simple team dynamic processes like closed-loop communication to software usability. In fact, Wichita State has the Software Usability Research Lab, where they do a lot of investigating of, if you set up a website to look like this, what will the effect be on how the user navigates through it? And, what are the conventions of software type design? So there's certainly no lack of design need there for if anybody's ever used a electronic patient care reporting system, we know.
I was just going to say, I guarantee every listener right now is thinking, how do I submit our EPCR software for evaluation and improvement to that?
Well, and there's, it's a wide open field there because, and just like a lot of people are focused on what does the patient compartment of an ambulance need to look like,
right,
in order for patients and providers to be safe. The neglected part of the truck is the cab, and what's the cab of the vehicle need to look like and flow like ergonomically so that we are less distracted, maybe not looking up at a menu on a screen, to conduct our tasks, which distract us from driving. So a lot of it is how do you make systems that people engage with safer, knowing what we know about how the mind works? And that's, I think, a good way to really view human factors as it applies to what we do every day.
I think this is a good time for us to really get into the medication cross-check thing and start to describe that, and then at the end we can tie in what is the research that you're going to be doing related to that.
Well, so back in July of 2011, we at Sedgwick County EMS experienced what appeared to be a spike in medication errors. And I think we had some 6 fentanyl reported errors for the month. And the traditional culture of blame is to bring the offenders in, punish them, and remediate them so that they never make that mistake again. And it was at that time that the deputy director of the time said, "You know what? We need a new perspective here. This isn't working." And one of the books that really, I believe, changed my life and opened my eyes to the field of human factors and really articulated some of the things that I felt as a field provider getting punished for making mistakes, felt deep down was really the way it really is the book by Sidney Decker called The Field Guide to Investigating Human Error. And so one of the things that Dr. Decker talks about in his book is what's called the local rationality principle, essentially meaning that providers generally, or pilots, system operators, don't come to work to screw up. They come to work to do a good job, to help people in their time of need, offer comfort, care, pain control, whatever it is that we can do to help people feel better and get where they need to go. They don't come in to work to intubate the esophagus or triple the dose of a drug and to hurt people, potentially. So the key concept there of local rationality is that what people are doing at the time had to make sense to that person, otherwise they would have done something different. So they didn't choose to screw up. It made sense at the time. So with the knowledge gleaned from Sidney Decker's text, we started to take more of a systems approach in understanding our medication errors that we did know about. And I won't argue that we know then or know now how many medication errors we have, but what was interesting was that no one had really been keeping a record of the number or the types. And so what we found is that what I imagine a number of other people would find is that you have more narcotic errors than you have any other kind of medication. Now, is that because there's something special about fentanyl or Ativan? Or is it because the process is designed to catch those types of errors when you have to go reconcile a Schedule II narcotic and actually verify that the amount of liquid left in the syringe or the vial is actually how much is supposed to be there? And so what we found is that there was a number of errors people were committing that they didn't know about. And so it also influenced by James Reason's book, Human Error. He's also got a number of other books, but it was heavily referenced in the Institute of Medicine's publication, To Error Is Human. And James Reason talks about classifying errors as either errors of intent, errors of action, errors of outcome, or errors of context. An error of intent would be, I meant to do the wrong thing, and I did the wrong thing, which, is actually classified in human factors language as a mistake. That was a bad plan. You did it properly, but it was not the right thing you should have been doing at the time.
Presumably for the right intent.
Right, correct. So then an error of action would be, I meant to do the correct thing. I meant to give the appropriate drug at the appropriate time. But when I actually put my thumb on the plunger and pushed the liquid out of the syringe, I did the wrong thing. And that, an error of action in human factors language, is described as a slip. It's an error of execution, not one of intent. So the question became, the natural response is to, again, just to exhort everybody to do the five rites. By God, everyone is going to do the five rites every time, no questions asked, and you're going to go through it because that little miracle will prevent whatever error you were about to commit. And so I asked a question of our service, because I wasn't settled with that plan, that intervention, to just admonish everyone to do the five rites. And so the question we asked of our service was, is, do you actually do a verification when you give a medication? And lo and behold, 100% of providers that responded to the survey said, yeah, I do a verification. So is it really a medication error for lack of verification, or is it possible that the verification we're doing isn't doing what it's supposed to do? And so we ask the question, when you verify, is it a verbal or a mental process? And the overwhelming majority of responders in our agency said, no, it's a mental process. You think about stuff. And so the question becomes, is a one-person mental process sufficient to stop an error in production? And I contend, and a whole host of human factors and crew resource management literature would argue that a one-person mental process is probably not a great way to catch a whole lot of errors, because, again, with the local rationality principle, the question would become, how do you stop somebody from doing something that makes sense at the time? And so that's the question we began to tackle with, okay, we need a verbal verification process that can stop somebody from doing what makes 100% perfect sense at the time. And that requires another person. And that person has to engage in that process, much like the World Health Organization's pre-surgical checklist, so that we don't make slips or lapses that your most highly skilled, knowledgeable, expert providers are the most prone to do. So,
I think you hit on an important point, that the second person has to engage in that process too. Because I find sometimes when you're doing a check of a drug, for example, with a second person, are they really paying close attention when you say, "Is this the right drug? Is it?" 0.2 mLs, do you agree? And yeah, oftentimes the other person just says, yeah, it sounds good, without really thinking through the process, without really being engaged, as you say.
Right, so it doesn't work if you don't do it properly, and that's what they found with the World Health Organization's pre-surgical checklist is, huh, we still cut off the wrong leg. Well, let's go back through how we did the pre-surgical checklist. Mm-hmm. And so then they go back and they investigate how they had a wrong site surgery, and well, okay, the surgeon was gowning at the back table and wasn't looking at the surgical site, didn't visualize the lateralizing mark of the site, and it was just kind of pencil whipped. And lo and behold, you have an error. So it really becomes a lesson for two people at that point in time, that You are a team here, and you are both responsible for giving this patient the correct dose. And so that really requires that both of you engage in the verification process. But it also reveals important information about the errors we continue to make, because what we're faced with now, you know, this cross-check procedure is by no means perfect. But what it does do is it inserts that second provider, and so if you have a medication error, the, that occurs with a genuine verification cross-check, now you have a medication error that penetrated two providers. And that is a system problem, not a bad Apple problem.
Oh, Hui, this is a lot of science mumbo-jumbo, not based on any facts. I'm an experienced paramedic. I've been doing this for 38-some-odd years. I don't need anyone to tell me what to do. I've memorized these lists over and over again.
The voice of dissent there, guys. How do you take that on?
Well, we had our share of that, and certainly it was the experienced providers, and we still, I imagine, with certain certainty that there are providers that still think that my way works just fine. And that may be true. Their way may work just fine tomorrow, as it did for the last 10, 15 years. But if we are going to make an improvement as a system, then we've got to be able to identify the errors that we do make, and which a credentialing process through our medical director's office does pretty well. At one point we had, I think it was, of the individuals who were being credentialed in 1 year, there was, I believe, 31% of the providers made a medication error that they did not know about. They walked out of the room thinking they had done everything properly, and then are confronted with the reality that, no, you made a medication error back there, and you didn't know about it. So as we rolled it out, there's a lot of dissent and disagreement and that, maybe you don't trust me to do the right thing. We trust, that you'll do the right thing. It's the errors that we don't know about that we're targeting with a standard process, which is really where medicine is going today. And, my brother being a surgeon, I get to hear the same dissent that occurs in among surgeons as that occurs among paramedics. It's darn near the same type of argument that, I don't need some checklist to tell me when or how to do this surgery.
But they leave 6,000 sponges in people every year.
So Paul, a little along Bill's line of thinking, I'm in an ambulance. We're a team of two. I'm in the back of the ambulance by myself. How do we deal with this? Short of having IBM's Watson in the back with you, how do you do the double check, or is there an alternative?
Well, so when we talk to our crews and we ask, how do you do your verification process? There's a significant proportion that said, and even after rolling this out, said, no, my partner and I were already kind of doing this, and that's great. We said, that's fantastic that you're already doing this. We just would like you to dress it up this way. And so then everybody goes to the, and even when this was, Dr. Braithwaite discussed this at the Eagles conference in Dallas this year, that was one of the questions from the audience. Well, what about when I'm in the ambulance in the back by myself? Well, that is what I would say is the engineered crumple zone of this process, is when you're in the back by yourself, it precludes any kind of significant engagement from the second provider, because they're performing a task. They're driving, and we don't want to distract them. But, you can certainly verbalize what it is you're about to do so that perhaps things become apparent that weren't before. And in essence, it's an engineered pause point, which is something that carries over from aviation. As if we've got we need a pause point here. The pre-surgical checklist is a pause point to slow down and be methodical. In fact, this
you can't let that go by. And here is and only because I know time is running short, and we really probably need to carry this on in a second episode and stuff, because there's a lot to discuss here. I think one of the challenges is that our training or our education, depending on how you want it, sets us up for failure, because we teach people first to memorize stuff. We test them on their memory capability, and then we tell them it has to be done quickly. So we're not setting it up from the beginning to be successful. And I just think that's an important thing, because I think it's going to be a challenge for us to change people who are the waning part of their careers or are unwilling to look at new processes. But I think where we need to make the intervention is in the initial education. Now, the challenge, of course, there is convincing paramedic program directors, who are often people that trained in an old way and old methods, to look at there is a better way to do this. You know, really, how much of what we do is time critical that needs to be done within 30 seconds for a minute?
Absolutely, Bill. And one of the things we talk about is really the patient needs the right drug slower than they need the wrong drug faster. And we've even had some of the more experienced individuals make a wrong drug error, and because they wanted to do it quickly and they were too good to verify. They don't need to, you know, check with anyone else, and a med error occurs, and what have we accomplished for that patient? So it really, I think what you've hit on is it's really more about, when we make those arguments, it's really more about us and making our own personal argument than it is about, you know, what the patient would say. We had a number of people say, well, I'm concerned about this pre-process making me look stupid in front of a patient. And to which I guess my best response is, well, you know, do you tell a pilot of an aircraft that the checklist really kind of makes him look foolish, and that, you know, you're okay with it if he just wants to skip that part?
Yeah, when they're out there walking around the plane before we take off, I would never say that. I would say thank you for walking around the plane with your flashlight and looking at everything.
But they're also not going through the checklist with the passengers listening in. So,
but we're all watching them.
Right.
And you stand at the window and you look out and you watch them pre-flight check the plane.
Not when they're in the cockpit is what I'm referring to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, also think that the crew of a plane is also the stewardesses who go through the seatbelt regime. And we all love taking that card out that everyone's touched and probably catch some kind of cold. And we love doing the seatbelt for. But that's part of like the teamwork of getting the crew integrated into kind of a role of teaming with the entire passenger body. So.
Hey, guys, Bill was right. We are running short on time, and I think this is a topic that deserves a part two. I'm sorry we didn't consider that in advance, but we really should wrap up. We like to be at about an hour. We sure have appreciated the conversation so far, and offline, hopefully we can schedule you to come back. Would you be willing?
Absolutely. Definitely.
That would be wonderful. This has been just a fascinating conversation, and every time I think I have pretty good knowledge on any given topic, then we have a show like this and I think, oh crap, I got a lot to learn. So I've put a lot of resources in the show notes, listeners, books and podcasts and presentations that have been mentioned. And we'll also be sharing those at facebook.com/EMSEducast. We do like to wrap up with a recommendation or an endorsement, something we want to share with EMS educators around the world. Bill, do you have something for us this week?
No, I don't. I have to tell you, my mind's been on preparing for other things this week, so I'm going to have to pass on anything good.
Okay, well, best wishes next week in Aruba, Bill. How about you, Rob?
I'm glad you asked me, Greg, because I was afraid you might take the one that I was planning to use.
Uh-oh.
So, well, first, before I get to my recommendation, I want to thank both Paul and Joseph for coming on the show. This has been a cerebral challenge for me, and I'm thinking of ways of how to use the term cognitive ergonomics in my everyday conversations for a couple of weeks now, because I absolutely love that term, cognitive ergonomics. What's with these cognitive ergonomics here? I love it. So my recommendation, so I enrolled in my very first MOOC, which is a massive open online course by Coursera. And there are several organizations that offer MOOCs. And it's called Cardiac Arrest, Therapeutic Hypothermia, and Resuscitation Science. And I know Greg Fries is enrolled in it with me. It's a six-week course through the University of Pennsylvania. And these are free, these MOOCs. And so if you get the opportunity to sign up for a MOOC, that's one I'd recommend. Now, they on the Coursera site, which is Coursera.org, they don't have a date for the next one, but there's a great, great selection of courses, lots of them really geared towards educators. So that would be my recommendation of the week. And Greg, if that was yours, I'm really sorry.
Well, I have a different angle on it. I know Paul and Joseph, we gave you a short notice of the recommendation, but do you have anything you want to recommend or endorse for our listeners?
Joe, you go first. Sure. I don't know the exact citation, the name of the article. It's a journal article written by my postdoctoral advisor called The Wisdom of the Collectives. And Salas, S-A-L-A-S, would be the lead author. I believe it might be Salas, Rosen, Burke, and Goodwin, I believe, are the authors. I don't know if I'm putting them in the right order.
Maybe if you just send us a link to the abstract and
we'll do. Sure we'll that. Do. So The Wisdom of the Collectives. It's a very good paper to read if you want to learn a little bit about teamwork.
Okay. Awesome. Thanks for that.
So I'll recommend one that I already mentioned, Sidney Decker's book, The Field Guide to Investigating Human Error, because I really believe that can open up people's understanding to the fact that it's not just the last person who touched it when something went terribly wrong. That usually is the last ingredient in a stew that's been brewing for a while. And my brother and I used to do that to each other. You know, we'd break something, then set it up, and then the other person comes along and breaks it, and what'd you do? But the other one I'll recommend is an article in a journal from Cognition Tech and Technical Work. It's called Collaborative Cross-Checking to Enhance Resilience. And Greg, I think I sent that to you as part of an email. But I'd be happy to shoot that to you.
Paul, those sound like Six Sigma books.
No.
They sound like black belt Six Sigma.
No, they have. There's no Sigma in there.
They certainly fit in that category.
No Greek letters, I promise.
I like it. Love it.
It's a lot of just understanding the nature of human thought processes and when things can go terribly wrong. So. And a lot of takeaways on what we can do to improve the safety for patients and providers.
I sometimes wonder, and I think I know the answer, how keen our listeners are, because I listen to you guys talk, and it's been a fantastically riveting, interesting conversation with you guys doing most of the talking, but interesting for me. And I'm gonna download the Field Guide to Understanding Human Error on my iPad as soon as I get off this call.
Good. Fantastic.
Well, I also want to mention the Coursera MOOC, Cardiac Arrest, Hypothermia, and Resuscitation Science. I was just watching the week 3 videos before we recorded this episode, and one of the things that really struck me was I have a friend and mentor, Dr. David Johnson. He's the owner and medical director of Wilderness Medical Associates, and he once explained how your role as an instructor in answering students' questions is you only need to answer slightly more than what they've asked. When somebody asks, about, say, therapeutic hypothermia, you don't necessarily need to tell them everything you know about that topic. You just need to answer maybe slightly more than what they've asked. And I had this sort of wave of doom or anxiety wash over me when I realized watching this video that this incredible all this information is so easily available and accessible for anyone that's interested in any of these topics. And I could very well someday soon be teaching CPR and have a student say, I just finished this MOOC on cardiac arrest and hypothermia, and Dr. Abella was talking about such and such study. And so, Greg, what's your thoughts? And I was just like, oh, my gosh, this amazing resource is out there and everybody can access it. And how am I going to stay smarter than the students? And, but this is really an excellent course. I've done several of these Coursera courses, and it's by far the best. I think partly because I'm interested in the topic, but also the quality of presentation. And then I just have a bunch of pals like Rob that are in there, and other listeners and guests from the EMS Edcast. So it's not too late to join, and certainly be looking for your own MOOC experience soon. So with that being said, on behalf of the about-to-be-wed Bill Toon and the about-to-be five-day-a-week paramedic Rob Terrio, this has been Greg Freese for the EMS Educast, and so big thanks to our guests.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, guys.